This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Chicago is home to people and cultures from all over the world, including a large Kurdish community. The story of how they came to America is an epic one, a story of bloody genocide, of freedom fighters, of sacrifice, and above all, perseverance. All this month, we've been hearing from host and reporter Rose Gilbert from Nashville Public Radio in a series called The Country in Our Hearts. It's focused on the story of one Kurdish family and their generations-long fight to exist. This is the final episode.
It's been months since I returned from Kurdistan, but I've kept in touch with the people I met there.
Hi, how are you?
Including Haleen and her mother Fawzia, Adan's aunt and cousin, who, you may recall, had been there visiting. Haleen and I had hiked the route the family fled decades before. Today, we're all back in Nashville. It's springtime, and they've invited me over to make kodas, little stuffed pastries that I first sampled back in Chalkir.
You need to taste and tell me how sweet it is. Like, do you think it's like overly sweet? Do you think you can just do more sweetness? You know what I'm saying?
We're in the final days of Ramadan. For observant Muslims like these women, that means no food or water until sundown. So it's my job to taste test the pastry filling, a ground mixture of coconut, spices, and sugar.
That's
good.
Yeah. It's sweet, but not too sweet right now. Yeah.
Haleen begins rolling out sheets of dough at the kitchen table, while her mom cuts out circles and stuffs them with coconut.
She's like, just look at what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Just watch my hands. Mm-hmm.
I pay close attention as Fawzia shows me how to fold over the delicate edges of the dough and do my best to copy her.
And you can make that flatter too.
Like pinch it.
Yeah, pinch it together. Give yourself some space to be able to fold it over.
Under Haleen and Fawzia's tutelage, I make my first koda, a neat little half moon.
You're a lady of the house. You're doing lady things, things I can't even do. I'm so jealous right now, I swear.
After that, we're off to the races. Fawzia and I fill tray after tray with pastries, while Haleen dashes back and forth from the kitchen to put them in the oven. Soon, one of Fawzia's friends stops by to join in.
Hello.
We spend the whole afternoon like this, chatting and churning out endless batches of fresh, beautiful kodas. While washing up in the kitchen, Haleen tells me Ramadan is always a special time for her.
I like to think of myself as a person of faith throughout the year, but it's this month that just grounds me. I feel more in tune with it. I feel more connected.
But this year, she says, things are different.
I feel like I'm back at a time when, after 9/11 happened, and, you know, you have that eerie feeling.
Anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant sentiment has been on the rise in America. Haleen says she worries for her parents, especially her mom, who wears a hijab and traditional dresses.
Just, what is someone going to do when they see my mom wearing a scarf because they're just scared for no reason kind of thing? So I tell them to keep vigilant.
Haleen's parents came to America as refugees in 1991. They found safety here and became citizens. Now, three decades later, there's a new wave of Kurds settling in Nashville, this time from Turkey, fleeing from political repression and nationalist hate groups. But today, they're coming to a very different America than the one that welcomed Haleen's parents. This America is a nation in turmoil, where immigrants are increasingly seen as enemies within, to be rooted out and sent back to where they came from. I'm Rose Gilbert, and from Nashville Public Radio, this is The Country in Our Hearts. This is Episode 4, The Kurdish American Dream. Haleen and I are sitting around the dining room table, taking a break from baking, when she says she has something to show me. She pulls out an old briefcase with a broken lock and opens it on the table.
Yeah, though, there's paper in here. Watch.
Yeah.
I need to find, there's actual paper that says, the Osmond family came to Nashville to stay. It's like really cool.
The briefcase is brimming with old immigration documents, documents that track this family's journey from a Turkish refugee camp to Texas to Tennessee.
And it has that refugee stamp right there.
As a kid, Haleen would spend hours looking through this briefcase, poring over its contents.
That's really cool.
Baby photos, visas, her dad's old MRI results.
One day I just went through every single paper in here, every single paper.
Why do you like looking through these documents?
It makes it feel so real. It's like the proof it's there. It's not just in my imagination. Like my parents actually lived through that. I remember the first time I looked through this, I was crying a couple of tears. I think it's that, like my parents lived this total different life than they do now.
Haleen, now in her late 20s, is the youngest in her family and was born in Nashville. These yelling bits of paper are a connection to her family's journey from Kurdistan, a journey that took place years before she was born. They tell the story of how they got to this country, and they offer tangible proof that they belong here.
Mm-hmm. Your naturalization papers, mother. They can't send you back that ticket. Well, because I saw this thing.
Haleen's name means bird nest in Kurdish. She tells me it's because she's the youngest, the one who completed their family and their home. And as the youngest, she spends a lot of one-on-one time with her parents. She lives at home, takes them to doctor's appointments, and keeps track of their blood sugar and medications. All that time together allows Haleen to ask lots of questions about her parents' lives in Çalke and their early days in America. Today, she's inviting me to join one of these conversations with her mom, Fawzia. Fawzia, now in her 60s, first learned about America in the Turkish refugee camp.
So pretty much when they came to like the camps and stuff, they would just tell them pretty much like that America is a land of opportunities. There's much you can get from it.
One day, officials came around, offering the chance to leave the camp and be resettled in the United States. After some deliberation among the men of the family, they left the refugee camp and boarded a plane to New York City.
She's like, of course, we're scared. We've never been on an airplane. We're scared. We're going to, how are we going to leave? Where are we going to go? How are we going to just go somewhere?
What did they bring with them, I ask.
Bossy get emotional. Just the clothes on their back.
Everything else, she says, they gave to family members who had decided to stay behind. Well, almost everything else. Fawzia says there were two things they were worried they wouldn't be able to find in this new country.
That's so cute. She said people that had came here before they came, said there's no citric acid here.
Citric acid, she explains, is a common flavoring in lots of Kurdish dishes.
So they brought citric acid and teapots, tea kettles with them. That's it. Laymin and chodang.
When they arrived at the airport in New York, Fawzia remembers being bowled over by the crowds of people. People who all look different, dress different. People from every corner of the globe.
So we thought, like, how do all these people cross oceans and stuff to come to a place like this? People from all over the world. Like, where do they come from? How did they all get here?
Everything about their new home was totally unfamiliar. Skyscrapers, streetlights, buying groceries instead of growing them, credit cards. Soon, Fawzia met other newly arrived Kurdish ladies, whose traditional dresses made them easy to spot around town.
Mm-hmm. فكنت فاهم لي جلد العادة كده وجا إجوا جيران المال الموندرا ده فور كأقول لما بالمي فور كي يا بدي هر إبرة أو كنت هم مي ده تنو فور كي ده شيء ده كنت خبوي كنت كين الله بفتري ما هو تبفتري ما هو أبغى
She's like, we would all get together at the park and we would just talk about, like, this happened to me today. This is something that happened. This is something that happened. So, like, it was just more of every day was something new, something shocking until it became a part of the reality.
Early on, someone warned her husband, Haleen's father, that burglaries were not uncommon in America. And he took that warning very seriously.
This is his sledgehammer from Notochore, 1994 in Dallas.
Haleen shows it to me. It's a heavy, rusted thing. She says her father stayed up with it night after night, patrolling the apartment.
My mom said all night, this man didn't sleep. For about a few months, they were scared to sleep. But my dad went from window to window, and he stayed there all night on guard for his kids. Until he realized, these people lie to me. Everything seems fine. But it's this literal sledgehammer right here.
After a while, they started to feel safe in their new home. Haleen's father started sleeping through the night, and they started to get to know more Americans, people outside their tight-knit bubble of newly arrived refugees.
Yeah, she's like, when you saw someone, if they knew you or didn't even know you, you know, from around the community, if they never saw you, they still are very kind to you and try to talk to you, and it's a Southern thing.
She recalls the people who helped get her signed up for WIC, helped her husband find work, helped her figure out how to operate the laundromat.
Like, did you feel welcome? Yeah. Did you feel welcome? A lot. They respected us and welcomed us very kindly.
But that's not today's America.
Within hours of taking the oath of office, I declared a national emergency on our southern border, and I deployed the U.S. military and Border Patrol to repel the invasion of our country.
In a recent move, the federal government has halted the refugee resettlement program.
To put it simply, there is no more asylum in the United States.
They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done.
Trump administration has canceled travel plans for refugees who were already scheduled to resettle in the United States.
You promised to end birthright citizenship on day one. Is that still your plan?
Yeah, absolutely.
After taking office, President Donald Trump signed a flurry of executive orders, one of which abruptly suspended the refugee program, the same program that allowed Haleen's family and thousands of other Kurds to come to America so many years ago. Beyond that, with the current political climate, Haleen worries. What if her parents get pulled over or are questioned by law enforcement who don't know that they're U.S. citizens?
And I'm like, Mom, Dad, where are your passports? You should just carry them with you just in case kind of thing.
She's seen videos of Rumeyza Ozturk, a Turkish PhD student and pro-Palestinian activist wearing a hijab, being detained by ICE officers who refused to identify themselves. The bulk of Nashville's Kurdish community came to the United States from Iraq decades ago. People like Haleen's family, who came here as refugees. But remember, the region of Kurdistan is spread across four countries. Since the coronavirus pandemic, there's been a new wave of Kurds coming to America, this time from eastern Turkey, or as Kurds call it, Bakur, and without an invitation from the U.S. government. Most have been coming over the Mexican border and applying for asylum. That means they are currently in the country legally, waiting on a final decision about their future in America, waiting to hear if America will send them back to Turkey, where they face discrimination, imprisonment, and even death. Asylum seekers are in a tough spot right now. The Trump administration has effectively suspended asylum at the border, and even if you make it to America, your chances of being able to stay here have plummeted. Immigration officers are arresting people for deportation at court appearances. Families report loved ones have disappeared, only for them to end up in El Salvador or South Sudan. The Trump administration has openly defied several court orders regulating deportations, and even lawyers who specialize in immigration law are confused. It's chaos. I walk up the driveway to a modern suburban home just south of Nashville. I see an American flag out front, and several pairs of children's shoes lined up neatly at the door.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
That's Shigar. He and his family are part of this recent wave of Kurdish asylum seekers from Turkey. I'm using a pseudonym because the family fears deportation and fears for the safety of their loved ones back in Turkey. Shigar invites me in, and we sit down for a big family breakfast. Spicy meat pastries, tahini, bread, fruit, and tea served in delicate glasses. After we eat, Shigar begins to tell me the story of why his family left Turkey. He speaks to me in Kurdish, translated by a friend.
We were a known family in our hometown. People knew us, that we were advocating for Kurdish rights. We were politically active. We were a known family.
They were wealthy and outspoken. They were active members of the HDP, the Kurdish political party in Turkey. And that, Shigar says, made them major targets.
I have seen a lot of problems. I have faced a lot of troubles because of my Kurdishness. Every step of life, I face difficulties and discrimination due to my Kurdish identity. Not for anything else, just for being Kurdish.
To understand Shigar's story, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the history of Kurdish people in Turkey. Like the Kurds in Iraq, they have a long backstory of oppression and resistance. Rebellions, massacres, and forced resettlement dating back to the fall of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. Then, in 1978, the PKK was founded, a militant Kurdish separatist group that waged guerrilla warfare against the Turkish government for years and years. For decades, the Turkish government had denied the very existence of Kurdish people, calling them Mountain Turks. Speaking Kurdish was banned. The words Kurd and Kurdistan were stripped from dictionaries and history books. And many historically Kurdish parts of Turkey were kept under martial law. The PKK was in part a response to this history of erasure and oppression. But some of their tactics, like suicide bombings and assassinations, caused the United States and Europe to label them as terrorists. They're controversial even within the greater Kurdish diaspora. To some, they're heroic freedom fighters. To others, they're troublemakers, doing more harm than good. In 1991, at the height of the conflict with the PKK, Turkey's government founded a new branch of their internal security force.
They called themselves JOHPE, J-O-H, Jandarma, or Forces Against Terrorism, against terrorists. They called themselves this, and they don't have to identify themselves, and they came for us.
The JOH was responsible for widespread human rights violations against Turkey's Kurdish population, including wrongful arrests, torture, and murder, according to human rights organizations.
There were a lot of disappearances in bright daylight. We would see people taken and never come back. They just disappear. But we all know it is Turkish government.
Kurds were seen as suspected terrorists, and Kurdish language, culture, and political activity were treated as inherently criminal. For years, speaking Kurdish at all was outlawed in Turkey. Shigar tells me his younger brother, who was 17 at the time, was arrested after attending a pro-Kurdish rally in 2012.
They came to our house and they took my brother. He was in high school.
His brother was charged with being a member of the PKK, promoting terrorism, and even attempting to assassinate the Prime Minister of Turkey.
They imprisoned my brother for a long time, for many years. Then he was released. After release, he went to Germany.
But even there, he wasn't safe. Shigar says that about a year after his brother fled to Germany, he was shot in the head and badly injured by members of a Turkish nationalist biker gang, a gang that German officials have accused of hunting down dissidents on behalf of the Turkish government. Back in Turkey, where Shigar and his family were, things took a turn for the worse. In June 2021, a woman who worked for the Kurdish political party was shot and killed in their Izmir headquarters. The shooter then tried to set the building on fire. Shigar knew the victim through his family's political activity. The man arrested for the murder was linked to the Grey Wolves, a wing of Turkey's far-right nationalist movement party that the European Parliament tried to designate as a terrorist group. In July, a month after that murder, a Kurdish family was gunned down in their home in the Konya province of Turkey. The mother, father, and five of their children were killed. Again, the shooter attempted to burn down the house.
They entered the house, and the family is sitting in the front porch, and they killed the mom, the dad, the son, and the daughter. They just shoot at them and kill them.
Before they were murdered, the family said they had been attacked by members of the Nationalist Movement Party, who told them they didn't want Kurds living in their neighborhood. And they said police weren't much help.
There is no apparent reason, for no reason. He just came, he knew they were Kurdish, killed them all. Because of this, I was very scared.
Soon after, Zhegar and his family were targeted.
They came to my house and they wrote down some of the fascists of Turkey. We call them fascists. They're kind of like, they cannot bear Kurds. They hate Kurds. They wrote down very terrible threats against me on my car, on my walls.
He shows me the pictures on his phone. Three red crescents spray painted across the hood of his car. The logo of the Nationalist Movement Party, the same party linked to the murders of the woman in Izmir and the family in Konya. And then, scrawled across the wall of his home, a warning.
The graffiti was telling us on the walls, leave, get out of here. After this family was killed, I was really scared and seeing this graffiti. So I went to the police and they said there is nothing they can do.
After he was turned away by police, Zhegar filed a complaint with a human rights organization. But that didn't feel like much protection. The noose was tightening and he needed to get out of Turkey now.
We were a very wealthy family helping the Kurdish cause and we left everything behind, all our factories or businesses. And my brother did the same thing as well. We all left.
Zhegar went first. He booked a flight from Istanbul to Mexico. From there, he crossed the border into Texas, where he surrendered to Border Patrol. He says he was surprised by how well Border Patrol officers treated them, compared to his family's experience with the GOH in Turkey.
They were very compassionate with us. They saw that we have children. They were very kind to our children. Overall, they were very nice to us.
Zhegar was held in detention for about a month. During that time, he applied for asylum in the United States. After being released from custody with a work permit and a far-off court date, Zhegar decided to move to Nashville. He'd done some research before he left Turkey and knew it was a Kurdish hub. A few months later, his wife and children followed the same journey, from Istanbul to Mexico and across the southern border, on foot, into the United States. They arrived right around Nowruz, the Kurdish New Year that marks the beginning of spring. A time for rebirth and renewal, an auspicious time for Zhegar and his family to begin a new life in America, together.
My first thoughts were, we are in the United States where the human rights are protected. We know that the United States is the best democracy in the world. And we know, I knew that they will protect my family's right, my human rights.
The American immigration process is famously slow going. In the meantime, they built a life in Nashville. They moved into a new house, they enrolled their kids in school, and they had a new baby, the first U.S. citizen in the family. Zhegar found work delivering pizzas, a far cry from the life he had as a successful businessman back in Turkey.
You know, in Turkey, I had a factory. I had a lot of employees working for me, under me. But when I came here, I was by myself, so I had to work for my family myself.
It was all worth it, though, he tells me, to be able to support his family. And to know they don't have to worry about the JOH or the Grey Wolves or the Nationalist Movement Party, that they can live freely.
Having the feeling and the thought that the government is not behind me, you know, chasing after me or trying to get me, and having a feeling of safety in the United States helped me a lot.
Still, the rules have changed since Zhegar and his family arrived in the U.S. Not long after this interview, I learned that another Kurdish family I had spoken to had been denied asylum and were going to be forced to return to Turkey. Zhegar and his family's asylum hearings aren't until next year, meaning that the feeling of safety they've found here is now in jeopardy. More after the break.
It's also the encounter
encounters with ICE. So you have the right, so ICE comes to you, you have the right to remain.
The week before my conversation with Jigar, I attended a seminar hosted by an immigration lawyer, a primer for immigrants in the event that they were detained or questioned by law enforcement.
Search warrant has to be signed by the judge, and you don't have to open the door for them.
Organizers handed out Know Your Rights cards printed in Arabic and Kurmanji, the Kurdish dialect most commonly spoken in Turkey. The seminar was attended by people from all over the world with all sorts of different immigration statuses. International grad students worried about traveling home for the summer, special visa holders who had worked with the U.S. military in Afghanistan, and a good number of anxious Kurdish asylum seekers from Turkey. I recognized a couple of people I'd interviewed before, including a community advocate who helps resettle new arrivals from Turkey. He told me that at least three Kurdish asylum seekers he knew had been detained by ICE following traffic incidents. Their families were told that they had been sent to a holding center in Louisiana to await deportation, the same center where Rumeyza Öztürk, Mahmoud Khalil, and other pro-Palestinian activists were kept. Since taking office, the Trump administration has deported over 200 Latino immigrants to a prison in El Salvador, including at least 50 Venezuelans who had entered the United States legally.
Leaders with the Tennessee State Highway Patrol Office confirmed traffic stops over the weekend led to ICE detainments in Nashville.
In Nashville, ICE has detained nearly 200 people following major traffic sweeps in Latino neighborhoods.
As people protested and confronted Homeland Security agents for answers, three buses came and went.
Shame! Shame! Shame!
People disappeared with little oversight or accountability, taken away by officers who, at times, cover their faces and refuse to identify themselves. It reminds me of the stories Jigar's told me about the gendarmerie in Turkey.
Well, I was worried. I was scared, honestly. Because I was hearing it's everywhere, that there were ICE police everywhere, but it wasn't until I saw them with my own eyes that when I would go to deliver or to work, I would see them on the streets. I was worried because I had to work, but at the same time, if I go out, I might be stopped by ICE.
In light of all this, Jigar tells me he drives very carefully. His lawyer told him not to worry too much, but he was also adamant that Jigar should keep his work permit and asylum paperwork on him at all times.
My lawyer says you have a right to asylum, you have legitimate reasons and fears not to go back. United States of America should protect you, because if you go back, it's not going to be good for you or for your family.
The situation in Turkey has only gotten more complicated for Jigar since he left in 2022. Years passed, and in December 2024, Jigar attended a rally in downtown Nashville. It was a protest against the most recent in a series of Turkish strikes in northern Syria, known to Kurds as Rojava, all part of the ongoing clash between the Turkish government and the PKK.
Turkey still sends their airplanes to bomb the Kurds, and they kill Kurdish people in northern Syria.
Since 2019, Turkey has carried out over 100 strikes on Kurdish-controlled Syria, an area the government views as a PKK stronghold. Those strikes killed dozens of civilians, including children. Nashville's growing Turkish-Kurdish population was outraged and staged a protest downtown.
Protesting is legal and is a right in the United States, peaceful protesting, and what we did was very peaceful. We just picked up our signs that says do not kill the Kurds in Syria.
I realized I knew exactly what he was talking about. I had been there too, covering the event as a journalist.
Rose Gilbert has the story. A crowd of about 60 gathered in front of the Christmas tree by Nashville's downtown courthouse.
After that rally, Jigar started getting panicked calls from loved ones back in Turkey.
I have the videos of the police coming to our house at 4 a.m. in the morning when my mom and dad were home.
He shows me on his phone about a dozen men dressed in black walking into his old building, which I recognize from the photos of the graffiti death threats. And then he shows me another video, sent by his aunt and uncle, of three police cars pulling up in front of their apartment. His family says the police asked about Jigar, where he was, where he was living, and if he was coming back to Turkey.
They ask such questions, but they never revealed why they were looking for me. They called it a private investigation.
And he wasn't the only one.
The Turkish government somehow got the pictures of people who joined the protest, and the police visited their address in Turkey to their parents' house, relatives' house, and asked those who joined the protest where they are, where their whereabouts.
Over 6,000 miles away, the gendarmerie were showing up to their families' homes, asking after them, and letting them know they had criminal charges waiting for them back in Turkey.
They have warrants waiting for them, yeah. Their investigation, and they have to show up at the court.
Today, Jigar is more scared than ever of the fate that would await him if the American government rejects his asylum claim and sends him back.
I am worried that if I go to Turkey, first of all, they will put me in jail. And after that, what will happen, we don't know. But we know from firsthand experience that people disappear under the custody of the Turkish police, Turkish government. And we have our relatives or neighbors or friends that were arrested by Turkish government and we never heard from them ever again. We don't have even their bodies to have a funeral.
I asked Jigar what he thinks about the Trump administration's dramatic crackdown on immigration. He was quick to reassure me that while he's deathly scared of being forced to return to Turkey, overall, he likes Trump.
We may see that President Trump seems like against immigration, and this could be true as well, but for Kurds, he's a good president. We like him.
I wasn't all that surprised by Jigar's answer. It echoes something I've heard before in my interviews with members of Nashville's Kurdish community. Large swaths of the Kurdish diaspora hold very favorable views of the Republican Party in general.
We're here to we support George Bush for liberating Iraq, but we would like to make sure that Turkey don't get involved because Turkey...
After all, under George H.W. Bush, the American military implemented a no-fly zone to protect Iraqi Kurds from Saddam Hussein. And under George W. Bush, they toppled Saddam for good. Also, at the end of the day, America is still the Kurdish people's best bet as a militarily powerful ally. Fondness for Donald Trump aside, Jigar does worry that the president's policies on immigration could hurt his children's futures.
I understand we are immigrants, we came here later on, but their future should be open. The obstacles in front of them should be removed.
I spoke briefly to Jigar's oldest son, who told me that he wanted to be a nurse or maybe a businessman. But for now, those dreams are on hold, he said, because he can't go to college. I asked him why, and he told me that in the current political climate, it felt too difficult, too risky.
For me, it doesn't matter. I'm old. We are old. It's not for me. For this generation, young generation, their future should be clear, should be open for them.
He gestures to his baby, the only U.S. citizen in the family, who is playing with a set of car keys.
These kids will be American. They will be raised here and they will serve the United States.
He seems so certain, so optimistic, which I suppose isn't all that surprising. After all, it is spring, the season for hope. This is the time of year when Kurdish people around the world celebrate Nowruz, which marks the end of winter and the beginning of a new year. The mythology behind Nowruz is deeply intertwined with the Kurds' history of oppression and resistance. Here's how it goes. Once upon a time lived an evil king named Zohuk, who had ravenous snakes growing from his shoulders. To keep the snakes satisfied, Zohuk ordered that two young men be killed each day, and their brains fed to the serpents. In this kingdom lived Kawa, a blacksmith who had lost six sons to Zohuk. He led a revolt against the tyrant, overthrowing him and allowing spring to return to the land. The legend goes that afterward, Kawa set fire to the hillsides to announce his victory.
The fire is a symbol of Nowruz. Without fire, there is no Nowruz. The fire is in the center of Nowruz.
The fire and Nowruz itself symbolize the triumph of light over darkness, rebirth, renewal, freedom from oppression. Nowruz is celebrated in many cultures in Western and Central Asia, but over the past century, it's become a powerful symbol of Kurdish identity, something that unites Kurds in Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and abroad. And like many other aspects of Kurdish culture, Nowruz celebrations have historically been targeted by authorities trying to quash Kurdish separatism. Jagar says that growing up during the height of the conflict between the Turkish government and the PKK, they had to celebrate quietly or not at all.
Yes, Nowruz was problematic in Turkey. When we joined Nowruz, there was always police presence.
He remembers one Nowruz bonfire he went to with his siblings when he was 20. JOH officers showed up. They weren't wearing their uniforms, he says, but he could tell they were police because they were carrying nightsticks.
And they attacked us, and I had to run away with my family.
They ran home as fast as their legs could carry them.
I ran inside and closed the door, but they saw which house I entered, so they broke the door and entered.
Jagar says he ran out the back door and escaped before officers could catch up with him. But his parents and his 16-year-old sister were still inside.
They took my sister, who were at home, and they hit her in front of my parents. They beat her down and they put it in the police car and they took it to the prison. And she stayed one night in prison and they tortured her. They beat her down really, really bad.
Despite these fraught memories, Jagar loves Nowruz. It's a hard-won light in the dark, making it fiercely cherished. So while he and his family are deeply scared of being forced to return to Turkey, that won't keep them at home this year. Jagar says they plan to attend as many as 4 different Nowruz celebrations across town.
Nowruz is a new life. It's Nowruz is a new beginning. Nowruz is a new page. It's like we restart life again.
Restarting life again. That's exactly what Jagar and his family are trying to do here in Nashville, like so many Kurdish families before them.
Can I use your blush, darling?
Yeah.
It's about 9 a.m. and I'm with Haleen, sitting on the floor of her bedroom in her parents' home in South Nashville.
Okay.
The same home where we had made qadas for Ramadan a few weeks earlier.
So we're just in the room, making ourselves look pretty, all dolled up to wear our beautiful Kurdish clothing.
We're getting ready to go to Nowruz. And as Haleen tells me, finding the right outfit is a huge part of that. With everyone gathering together to celebrate, it's an occasion to see and be seen, and everyone wants to look their best. Haleen starts pulling out dress after dress from her closet. Purple, hand-embroidered with tiny sequins, plain black, something sheer that floats as she lays it out on her bed.
This is cute. I think I'm gonna wear this one.
She holds up a dress with pink and white flowers. After some deliberation, she decides to add a black velvet vest, embroidered at the edges with tiny jet beads.
Well, there you go, ladies. I picked out my outfit. Good work. Thank you.
Styles vary between regions, but there are some common elements. Women's outfits often include a floor-length gown under a cropped vest or a long, robe-like jacket.
So right now I have my atak on, which is the underdress, and then I'm putting my kross on, my dress, which has the laundis, which is these long things that are connected to the sleeves.
So that's what the parts that like flutter in the wind are, is
yes,
the...
Yes, laundis.
Kurdish dresses are often dazzling, with sparkling beading and embroidery. Gold belts, headdresses, and jewelry complete the look. Haleen keeps it simple, with a gold watch and the delicate evil eye necklace she wears every day. With her encouragement, I'm wearing Kurdish clothing as well. An emerald-colored dress underneath a long, gauzy jacket, stitched with sequins.
But I see you're wearing green, and green's a beautiful color, and the flag. So we'll probably be seeing a lot of people wearing red and greens and yellow, maybe a lot of, like, Kurdish flags on their dresses and stuff. It's really cool to see every time and see how people dress up and stuff. Yeah.
Haleen loans me a necklace and helps me knot my long sleeves, or laundis, at the elbow to keep them from dragging on the ground. She ties her own behind her back, well out of the way.
You have any, like, black eyeshadow? Or, like, really dark brown?
And my eyeshadow palette's right here.
That's Haleen's 19-year-old niece, Cortland.
This is my first actual Nowruz celebration that I'm going to.
Once we're all dressed, we head outside and start loading up the car with everything we'll need for our picnic.
Okay, let's see. My teapot, my tea, my sugar, salt, pepper, veggies, food.
Cheers.
Haleen's older brother, Bijar, is driving us.
I'm driving. Oh, here's the keys.
Soon, we're on the road.
Okay, y'all can turn the music up real quick, just for a second.
The music up?
Yeah, turn it up.
This is one of those songs you always hear this time of year, she tells me.
Nowruz by Kowa.
This year's event is being held at the fairgrounds of Lebanon, a town about 30 miles east of Nashville. Hi. It's a beautiful day. The sky is blue, not a cloud in sight. I see clusters of women walking across the fields, their dresses and jewelry glittering in the sun. I see men in their jackets and loose trousers helping one another wrap wide sashes around their waists. Some of the younger crowd have paired their cultural outfits with graphic t-shirts and trendy sunglasses. I see kids playing soccer and begging their parents to buy them ice cream. And at the center of it all, the stage, hung with the banner of the American and Kurdish flags. As we set up our own little picnic area, Haleen's brother Bijar tells me he's always loved this holiday. He was 8 years old when his family fled Çelke, and some of his fondest Nowruz memories were from the refugee camp in Turkey.
I just remember it was a lot of joy, even, you know, going through all that hardship. But still, like, it was just, it was really joyful.
They didn't have much, but the kids would put on a play, acting out the myth of the blacksmith Kowa. Bijar says his oldest brother played one of the kids who got eaten by Zalhok's snakes. And of course, they had a bonfire, a pile of scavenged car tires set ablaze.
Big black smoke, hot, but it's like the Olympics when they turn on the torch.
At today's event, the Nowruz fire is contained to a neat brazier, ceremonially lit by a collection of prominent members of the community. That's when the party really gets going. I turn to Cortland as she takes it all in.
So exciting and so lively. So many people. The vibes are immaculate. Family's here.
We watch as people start gathering around the fire to dance, holding hands or linking pinkies. They begin to move, copying the steps of the person at the head of the line.
So you want to dance?
I do want to dance. I love dancing, but I've never Kurdish danced before, so I want to. It looks so fun.
Multiple lines and circles form, each performing different dances. Some are as simple as a couple of rhythmic steps, forward and backward, while others are truly athletic, with leaps and intricate footwork. As we sit in the sun, dressed beautifully and full of good food, I think of the stories I've been told by people here in Nashville, in Çelke, in Halabja. Stories of towns being bombed with chemical weapons, of families hiding in caves to escape armies, of desperate journeys through the mountains.
I think, you know, there's how they say there's light at the end of the tunnel. You know, the tunnel's dark. Kurds have a dark history of, you know, pain and suffering. But there's always light, Nowruz.
For Haleen, Nowruz is a chance to celebrate a culture those who came before her fought to pass on, even when it meant going up against police and armies and government. And for many Kurdish people around the world, that fight isn't over.
The reason why we should celebrate it is because there are Kurds that aren't able to or can't do it so openly or freely.
In Syria, Nowruz celebrations were banned during the Assad regime and later targeted by ISIS suicide bombers. Last year, police in Turkey attacked people leaving a Nowruz event, arresting over 100, including at least 3 journalists. And just this year, in Iran, police arrested dozens of people, including 6 children, for taking part in Nowruz festivities. I think of Jaygar and a story about escaping police at a bonfire when he was 20. I know he and his family are here, somewhere in the crowd. That's why they came to Nashville, after all, why they came to America. For the chance to be safe, to live somewhere where they can openly celebrate Nowruz, fly the Kurdish flag, speak their language, and wear what they want without fear.
And since we're able to do it so freely, it's an obligation to do it and to show the world that we are, again, resilient people that are going to express ourselves in the name of, like, justice and freedom.
The music playing from the main stage changes. Still upbeat, but slower. Haleen, Cortland, and I make our way to the field in front of the stage, where the Nauru's flame is still burning.
All right, yeah, let's go dance. Yeah. Perfect music, perfect tempo. It's beginner. This is the beginner dance.
We take our places in the circle of people, linking our fingers together, and we dance. The Country in Our Hearts was reported and produced by me, Rose Gilbert. My rockstar editor and co-producer was Marabin Knight. Additional editing by Tony Gonzalez, LaTanya Turner, and Rachel Iacovone, with help from Mariana Bacchiao, Char Dastin, and Justin Barney. Mac Limbaugh is Nashville Public Radio's Vice President of Audience in support of this project in many ways. Our community and cultural advisors on this project were Dr. David Romano and Dilman Yassin. Sound design was done by Martine Cruz, fact-checking by Daniel Potter, and original logo artwork by Nuveen Barwari. Traditional music was by Art Kandoski, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Paul McAdoo and Jennifer Nelson, and huge thanks to Mehmet Ayaz, who made so much of this storytelling possible. I want to express my appreciation for everyone who helped me with this project. The people who welcomed me in Kurdistan, like Azad Zamin, the Barmarni family, and the village of Chalke. And of course, the many journalists I met along the way. Thank you to Suha Kamel, Makin Mustafa, Polly Don, Nama Abdullah, and Vladimir von Vilgenberg. The Country in Our Hearts was made possible by the financial support of Nashville Public Radio listeners, and special contributions by members Jackie Schrago, Fletcher Burton, and William D. Kenner, M.D. Travel was funded in part by the Overseas Press Club, and the project received an important grant from Humanities Tennessee, an independent affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The findings and conclusions of this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Humanities Tennessee or of the National Endowment for the Humanities.